can.
Six a month.
Right, but if you have a medical excuse, I can do extra credit.
Okay, I do have the doctor's note. It's just, you know, it was hard for me to.
So if you have a doctor's note, come in Thursday and we'll give you an extra credit assignment.
Okay.
Because if you have a doctor's note, I'm allowed to do that.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
It's always 8:14 on Zoom and you're never
I know.
Every time you turn this computer on, it's 8:14.
And Wednesday.
Every single time. It's on
New York time.
Yeah. No, 14. It's on no time at all. I would say it could be New York time, but it's on, it's. Wow. I'm breathless. What a day it's been.
I know. I keep thinking about them. My legs are chained on the side of my mouth, and then my mouth misses what I'm just like, no, they wouldn't.
Page 22. This is one of my most favorite lectures. With this lecture, in a sense, I'm beginning the second sort of theme of the class. Because if you look at what's scheduled from now on and think of, you know, the actual name of the course, they wouldn't let me name it. So it's called The Artist in the 20th Century. But my name for this course was Cultures in Collision, Cultures in Fusion. And the whole first half of the class, except for that introductory section on the exhibitions, was about cultures in collision, if you think about it. And with Wilfredo Lam, we're sort of stepping into the part of the course that is cultures in fusion. And I like to think of Lam as sort of the epitome of a intercultural human being whose artwork really demonstrates an intercultural dialogue. So that's why I mean that it's sort of a step into the second major theme of the class. Just out of curiosity, if you've had this in another course of mine, please don't raise your hand. But if you haven't, how many of you have heard of Wilfredo Lam? Who? Yeah, look around you.
There they are.
Nobody. it's just amazing to me. How bad art history can be. When Wilfredo Lam was sort of began to be more canonical, when art history books started at least including his most famous painting, and when people started sort of using him more in dialogues about the 20th century, there was a really interesting article that was written, I think it was in Arts Magazine. And the name of the article was, "What's that painting over there by the men's room?" I'm paraphrasing, but that basically is the name of the article by a man named John Yao. And it was about the fact that although the Museum of Modern Art in New York City owned the most famous Wilfredo Lam painting of all of his works of art, it was sort of hidden by the men's room. And this seemed significant to a lot of people because Wilfredo Lam is a man of color. And there are not that many artists in the Museum of Modern Art's collection in the 20th century who are artists of color. Certainly by the end of the 20th century, and certainly in the 21st century, they've tried to make up for it. But this is a painter who really came upon an international scene in the 1940s. So it was sort of symptomatic of, you know, trying to change the way institutionally these artists were thought about, that article came out. And it was really sort of, in the English language, the first article to sort of deal with the issue of what are we talking, how come people don't know about Wilfredo Lam? And to this day, there is a brand new book recently by some very famous art historians, Survey of 20th Century Art, and wouldn't you know that Wilfredo Lam was not in it, and it was like a brand new book. So that, you know, there's always work to be done, I guess is my feeling about this. And I think for me, Wilfredo Lam is sort of emblematic of the work to be done. His years are 1902 to 1982. And I'm sorry, I did call in the fact that backlight is out, and this, I have to recall it in. Changing a light bulb seems to be a very difficult thing. Isn't there some joke there?
Yeah,
right. So anyway, Wilfredo Lam was born in Cuba, first problem, I guess. And he was born of an immigrant Chinese father and what the word they use in Cuba is mulata, and it is not derogatory. I want to admit, because in Mexico it kind of has a different connotation. Mulata is somebody of black plus another race, okay? And a mulata mother, she was Hispanic and Afro-Cuban. And in their household was also, which is very typical of Cuba, or many countries, I guess, a woman who helped raise the children, and she was an Afro-Cuban, and she practiced one of the most famous religions in Cuba, a religion called Santeria. Okay, so you get, from the get-go, a multicultural environment that Lam is born into in a small provincial town in Cuba. I'm beginning with this slide because I think it's going to help you understand the rest of my lecture. This is in case you don't recognize him. This is Pablo Picasso, right? And this is Wilfredo Lam. And they were very, very close friends. They were many years apart. Lam was much younger than Picasso. But Lam was sent to study. He was sent to first Havana to study art because he had just this natural ability that everybody recognized. And in many countries of the world, you can ask for entrance into national boarding schools that specialize in different things. So he was sent to Havana. And at a young age, at the age of 21, he won a scholarship to go to Spain to study art. Now, the art that he studied in Spain was very, very traditional art. And but he happened to be there during the Spanish Civil War, which you already know about. Little footnote here, in the most recent issue of both the New York Times Book Review and the San Francisco Chronicle Book Review, The Sundays, there is a new book out by a Spanish poet, and it's a book that is about Spain facing up to the horrors of their own civil war. And there's a law that the parliament in Spain has to vote on momentarily, about how Spain should officially deal with the situation of their own civil war. We have a somebody from Spain here. Have you heard about this? No. Send an email to your mama and tell me what she says, okay? But this was headlines in Sunday's newspapers. So what I'm teaching you comes back, you know, in daily life. It does come back. Anyway, Lam was in Spain as an art student during the Spanish Civil War, and quite frankly, 1932 to 38, he was there. He fought for the Republican part of the war, the Republican group, which was the anti-fascist, anti-Franco group. So when Franco won, he is forced to escape from Spain. But he does not choose to go back to Cuba because he's an art student and wants to be really sort of international, et cetera, et cetera. And his friends in Spain give him a letter and they send him straight to Pablo Picasso. Now, you also know about Pablo Picasso and something that happened at the end of the 1930s, because I've taught you that. What is it?
Guernica.
See? You're gonna figure this out. They become very good friends, right, at this point. Remember, Wilfredo Lam is a painter. And so in 1938, he left for Paris. And, you know, here you have them together a little bit later. This is 1963. But they've been friends all along. And Picasso kind of takes Lam under his wing. When Lam first gets to Paris, he doesn't have a job. You know, he doesn't have a place to live, et cetera, et cetera. So in Paris, Lam unofficially joined a circle which included Michel Leres, who you've already learned about, Dakar Djibouti, right, Michel Leres, and Pablo Picasso, and that whole idea of ethnographic surrealism. So here, the very dark-skinned Wilfredo Lam ends up in Paris, and he finds that instead of sort of this all-white Parisian scene, he's immediately thrown into an intellectual environment in Paris where they're all looking at Africa. And remember that they thought Josephine Baker was African, right? Well, look at them looking at Wilfredo Lam. So he immediately is thrown into what for him, I believe, was a very sort of perplexing situation, because he's never self-identified in terms of being mostly Afro and Chinese. You can see that so the Afro element is sort of major, the Chinese element is minor. You know how genes work, you never can tell. My son never had curly hair. He's happy about it, I cry. You know, you never know, you just never know. So Lam goes to classes along with Michel Leres and the whole group of people in Paris on African art, because this is that whole Mission Dakar Djibouti where all the objects come to Paris and Leres starts teaching at the Sorbonne, etc., etc. So all of a sudden, Lam is into this environment in Paris. So here is a photograph of Lam in his Paris studio in 1940. And he begins to be prolifically a painter. So we're dealing with between 1938 and 1940 at this point. He is such a prolific painter at this point that the Paris art dealer Pierre Loeb, L-O-E-B, gave Lam a contract and a one-person exhibition in 1939, so that he immediately began to have success, right? But I want to show you, so interesting, this is a still life that won him the award to go to Spain. Okay? Very competent, very, very competent, but, you know, very traditional still life. He gets to Paris, 1938, and look at this painting. So immediately there's a vocabulary of cubism that he begins to incorporate into his work. So this was an enormously important move from Spain to Paris. And again, you all know it, but I do have to remind you, in 1937, Picasso did Guernica in Paris, and it was still up probably in 38. You know, I tried to find out when that building for the World's Fair was taken down, and I just can't find out exactly when Guernica was no longer on display. But this is, you know, the year after it was done, 1938. So I'm going to assume that Lahm saw it, and if he didn't see it, he certainly heard about it, saw magazine articles about it, because it was really so important for Picasso at this particular moment. So I want you to look at it carefully, stylistically, because it does have a legacy in Lahm's work. And we've looked at it before, right? So you know, people always talk about Picasso in terms of cubism, but quite frankly, Picasso was a surrealist. If you also, you know, if you look at this as an example of Picasso's painting, you get surrealism, you get the fantastic, you get, you know, a dreamlike atmosphere where things really don't mesh, but they merge into each other. You get much looser forms than you would ever get in cubism. And it's this Picasso that really then begins to have an influence on Wilfredo Lahm. This is the sort of the quintessential kind of Picasso that has an influence on Lahm. Now, ironically enough, it was during this same period, 1938 and 39, that two very important Cubans were also in exile, political exile in Paris, intellectual Cubans, literary Cubans. One is named Alejo Carpentier. Just remember Carpentier, C-A-R-P-E-N-T-I-E-R, and Lydia Cabrera. And I'll spell Cabrera, C-A-B-R-E-R-A. They were both writing essays, short stories, poems, and they just missed meeting Lahm personally in Paris. But they were part of this Parisian international scene. And very interestingly, Cabrera's first book of poetry was published in French in Paris in 1938. This is important because the name of it is Cuentos Negros, or Short Stories of the Black, meaning the black human being, right? So I just want you to appreciate this cultural mix. And Josephine Baker was there at this point. You know, I've always thought somebody has to do one book on a five-year period in Paris, in the back of the room. For her book?
Yes.
38. I'm still just pre 40 in the lecture. So this is an enormously exciting, very multicultural period of time in Paris. I mean, there's a lot that I'm leaving out, but I think the message is how multicultural and experimental it actually is. Now, in these same years in Havana, so I'm going to go 1937 to 1940, this is a very specific time period, there was a man named Fernando Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, who was working in Havana. And he founded the Association of Afro-Cuban Studies. He was a white Hispanic Cuban who had gotten a law degree in Madrid, came back to Cuba, started practicing law, and defending prisoners. And by defending prisoners in Havana, he was immediately thrust into the Afro-Cuban world, because 75% of all prisoners were Afro-Cuban. Shouldn't surprise you, look at our own culture, okay, right? And so here we have this white Hispanic lawyer who is thrust into the Afro-Cuban world and says, basically, I have to get to know this world, because this world is my country. Why are all these people in prison? What are they doing? What are our politics all about? Fernando Ortiz is probably the Caribbean's first anthropologist, without that word being legitimate at that point in history. And he's considered the father of Afro-Caribbean studies. So he's at the same time that this is going on in Paris, there's sort of a parallel thing happening in Havana. How does it connect? In multiple ways. The first way is that Fernando Ortiz is Lydia Cabrera's brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that when Alejo Carpentier and Lydia Cabrera come back to Havana, they are immediately into this world, this brand new world of understanding and studying the Afro-Cuban. Okay, that's the one big connection. You're going to get to the second connection in a moment. And it's coming up right now. Okay. Paris fell to the Nazis in 1940. How many, oh goodness, Humphrey Bogart in
Casablanca.
How many of you seen that movie? A little bit more than heard of Wilfredo Lam. The classic scene is, well, there's a million classic scenes, but the scene that's affecting my lecture is the bottle of Vichy water. Right? He has a bottle, you know, you all drink this purified water, you're going to get so sick when you travel. There was just, I don't believe me, read the science reports, but it's, you know, it's a bottled water. And there's this famous, famous little cut in the movie where Bogart is walking, think to the airplane, and he takes the bottle of Vichy water and throws it in the garbage. Well, the Vichy government in Paris is the Nazi government. And France is basically cut in half by the fall of Paris. The southern part of France remains relatively free of Nazi control, and the whole northern part of France, along with the city of Paris, falls under Nazi control. At that moment, 1940, if you haven't left, it's about time you better leave. Okay? So there's a mass exodus of intellectuals, left-wing people, Jewish people, etc., out of Paris at this particular moment. Second part of the story is what's on the screen. This photograph was taken in right outside of the city of Marseille. And Marseille is on the Mediterranean border in southern France, and it is a major, major port city. And what happened at this point is Marseille became a haven for people needing visas to leave France for other countries, people who were sure to be imprisoned, sent to concentration camp, killed, etc. And so Marseille became sort of what Zurich, Switzerland was like when we studied Zurich, Switzerland. It was a place where people fled to and then tried to leave legally or illegally. If you look at a map, there's people who walked from Marseille across to the Pyrenees and into Spain. And some made it, some didn't make it, etc. And there was a American United States man named Varian Fry, F-R-Y, who was sort of an double agent, sort of an undercover agent. He was working for the American Friends Service Committee in Marseille, but he also, at his office and his desk, ran the business of trying to get visas from wealthy, influential people in the United States to get people out of Marseille. And he helped this group of artists that you see on the screen set up a residence area where they could work and be together in sort of a, you know, a country home outside of Marseille. What you're looking at here is Wilfredo Lam. Do you recognize him? With other artists who are all here in the in this little sort of country estate right outside of Marseille, and they are they're there together. Well, Lam is there for a good 10 months, waiting for a boat, waiting for permission to leave, and it's the winter of 1940-41 that you're looking at in these slides. Now, I have to do a really important footnote here. It's somebody I've also talked about. This is what I mean about intercultural dialogue. The man's name is André Breton. Do you remember me mentioning him before? Okay, it's sort of interesting. I decided last night to go online and look at all these sort of biographies about Breton that were online, and of course I was horrified. I'll tell you why in a minute. Let's quickly go over Breton. In 1919, he began working in literature and avant-garde literature, and he met the Dadaist Tristan Tzara, right? In 1924, he founded the Bureau of Surrealist Research. You don't have to memorize the whole thing, folks. By 1924, he was experimenting with the principle of automatic writing. A group formed around him, and names of that group that you all know, such as Michel Laris, Tristan Tzara, Antonin Artaud. He combined his avant-garde thinking with left-wing politics and joined the French Communist Party, from which he was expelled in 1933. During this time, and I'm reading directly from one of the entries, he survived off the sale of paintings from his art gallery. So that by the 1930s, he was also running what was considered an avant-garde art gallery. In 1938, so this brings us to that period, 1938 to 1940, that I've been discussing, Breton got a cultural commission from the French government to travel to Mexico, just in time, we think, right? With you know, World War II sort of fuming. But there was somebody really interesting living in Mexico at this point, a man named Trotsky. Those of you who know about Soviet politics and left-wing politics know about Trotsky. And I will talk about Trotsky again, because Breton goes to Mexico and he meets with this circle of people, and Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo and Leon Trotsky are there. So we're going to learn about this again from the point of view of Mexico coming up. And by 1940, Breton, interestingly enough, goes back to Paris to join the medical corps of the French army. And in 40, the same year, when Paris falls to the Nazis, the Vichy government banned his writings, and I quote, as the very negation of the National Revolution. So he was an enemy of the Vichy government, so he had to flee. So what happens is Breton also flees to Marseille. And at this particular moment, Wilfredo Lam meets André Breton. It is a meeting that changes both of their lives. So they meet in Marseille, and Marseille becomes this country home that they all hang out in. Here they are at the Villa Herbel, is the name of it, in 1941, and there's a whole group of surrealists here, and they put on little exhibitions for each other. So here you see them putting their paintings in trees and putting on plays. Sort of gives you a general idea. André Masson joins them in Marseille at this period, and they all congregate at the Villa Herbel. So Lam begins to work with André Breton. They start a collaboration. And remember that André Breton is doing, is working with automatic writing, automatic drawing, one of the core principles of surrealism. And what happens is that he asks Wilfredo Lam to illustrate a series of drawings that Breton writes about. Breton writes it and Lam illustrates it, and it's about Fata Morgana. So I had to look this up. I know there's some people in this class who probably know who he is. Fata Morgana was King Arthur's sorcerer, King Arthur of the Round Table. He was his sorcerer. The whole important point about this is what Breton was into intellectually, into sorcery, into automatic writing, into collaborating with artists who were also doing these kinds of experiments. So here you see on the screen a collective collage that was done in Marseille called Jeu de Marseille, the game of Marseille. Okay? And Lam participated in this, Breton participated in it, some of the other artists there. So this is their version. And again, you can see, I mean, I don't know who did this part of it, but we sure know that they've looked at Picasso, right? So that you can, I think you can begin to see, here's, you know, the ethnic other, right? You can be see many of the influences that you've learned about so far in this class. And here they are doing this kind of experimentation. They all play surrealist games, and the Vichy government starts to close in. There is no record in all the biographies that I happened to go to last night. They don't include this information. They just say that he went to the United States and the Caribbean in 1941. They don't talk about Marseille, which is so important, and this is also what happened. Finally, there was a boat that left Marseille. André Breton and his wife, Wilfredo Lam and his wife, and some of you might know the great anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, the father of structuralism, was also on that boat. So there was a boat that left, and this group of people got on the boat together. And the boat sails for the United States. And actually, in Claude Lévi-Strauss's book called Triste Tropique, I only know it by its French title. I think even in translation, they use the French title. Chapter 1 in that anthology about Brazil is actually about this boat trip, that this famous, famous boat trip that they took. So they were all together on the boat. Now, you have to know something that about politics during this period. There were many boats that tried to come to the United States, and many of them were turned back. There's a famous example of a boat full of Jewish people that was turned back, only to be completely wiped out. The boat that, and I don't have the name of the boat written down, I'm sorry about that, but the boat that that Lam and Breton and Lévi-Strauss, et cetera, their whole group was on, went to different ports in the Caribbean trying to get permission to land. They ended up in Martinique, because Martinique is a French protectorate. But what happened in Martinique is so interesting. Martinique is a French protectorate, so Martinique's government is pro-Vichy at this moment. But they let them land, and then they put them in a, we would call it like a displaced person camp, a DP camp. Everybody on this boat had to stay in a certain encampment until all the legalities were tested. And this is like another incident. So Marseille is really important for Lam's career, and Martinique becomes quintessentially important, not just for Breton and Lam, but for the whole history of black consciousness beginning in the 1940s. It's one of just these things. They walk into, Breton and Lam walk into a store. Here they are in Martinique. Nobody has ever published the full photograph that I know, so I have no idea who's sitting on the other side of Lam. I did not put tape on this. This is how I found it in a book. So I cannot tell you who this person is, unfortunately. But here is Wilfredo Lam, and here is André Breton sitting in Martinique. They went into a general store type area, and they saw a stack of magazines on the floor, and they picked it up and started looking at it, and they realized the author of the articles in these magazines in French, right, Martinique is a French protectorate, was a man named Aimé César, C-E-S-A-I-R-E. And his wife, Suzanne César, did the illustrations. How many of you, just curiosity, have ever heard of Aimé César? Okay. This man is probably one of the most phenomenal intellectual leaders of black consciousness in the second part of the 20th century. He wrote a book that I'll talk about in a moment that changed, I don't even know how to say this, that changed so many people's lives. So Lam and Breton meet the Césars, Aimé and Suzanne César. Aimé and Suzanne César were adamantly pro-Afro. They had both gone to school in Paris. They had hung around with the black intellectuals of Paris. They were forced to leave and go back to Martinique, because we're here right on the 1941, right? And they began a friendship for this very condensed period of time. And Lam actually was reacquainted with the Caribbean that he had left at the age of 23 through Aimé César and Suzanne César. This was Lam's entree back to the black Caribbean, the Afro-Caribbean. Suzanne César, all of her illustrations were based on vegetation in the Caribbean. This is so important when we finally get to the paintings. I know you're wondering, when's she going to get to the paintings? In a minute, right? But all of her illustrations were based on the natural vegetation, the natural beauty of the Caribbean. And César's most famous book was a book that he did in this time period. I have to translate it into English. Return to the Native Land. I'm really close to the English title. Return to the Native Land. In 1941, Lam and his wife, Helena Holzer, get permission to, at the end of 1941, to finally go from Martinique to Havana. Okay? So I just want to catch up with myself. Here we have Breton Lam. Here we have 1943, Helena Holzer, in their living room in Havana. I would like you to look at how much African art is surrounding them. They land in 41, and here's 43. That dealer I talked about way back at the beginning of my lecture, I would never test you on this, Pierre Loeb, also Jewish, had to flee Paris, and he brought the Lams their African art collection in a couple of suitcases. So here they are in Havana, where there is no collection of African art in the 1940s. And here they are with their, you know, their African art collection. That's actually oceanic, but this is African, this is African, this is African, this is African, this is African. That's a Wilfredo Lam painting. But this is how they set up house in Havana. And Wilfredo Lam, for the rest of his life, collected African art. This is in 1972 in Paris, but he is surrounded by his own collection of both oceanic and African art. So this is something that he carries on the rest of his life. Michel Leras taught him how to do this in Paris after Mission Dakar Djibouti, right? And here we have Wilfredo Lam in his backyard garden in Havana in 1943. I'll make it, okay? So, they, in 1943, Lam and Helena Holzer have settled in Havana, and he had begun painting again. They enter Havana, and they are immediately joined up at the circle with the two people I talked about, three people, Lydia Cabrera, Alejo Carpentier, and Fernando Ortiz. So that's why it was important for me to introduce those names before. So this is a circle of people that they decide that that's their circle of friends in Havana. And Cabrera was, by this time, doing research among Afro-Cubans, and so was Carpentier. So, here we have Lam in his backyard. Here we have Lam in front of the painting that hung by the bathroom. right? It's not this little one. It's this big one. 1943. He's in his Havana studio in front of this painting, and here is the painting. This is a breakthrough painting of the 20th century. I don't care where you are in the world. It, to me, is one of the most major works of art of the 20th century. And it's called, unfortunately, The Jungle. There's no jungle in Cuba. I've done a lot of, as you can tell, I've done a lot of research about this man, and I still don't know who named this. It was named in Spanish, and it's 1943, and it's The Jungle. Now, this is a huge departure from anything you have seen yet in this class. The one thing it should remind you of a little bit is Guernica, right? It's got the same, it does not remind you of Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon, stylistically, really? See what I mean? It's not quite Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, but of course, Lam knew about that, paint Les Demoiselles. This is Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon of 1906, I've said, okay? But let's go back to The Jungle, okay? What happened between the year 1941 and 1943 that Wilfredo Lam really bursts out with this absolutely very large, incredible painting, five times the size of that blackboard. I forgot to take down the size, but it's big. Let's look at it closely. First of all, Aimé César and Suzanne César happened, and I told you that Suzanne César was looking at the return to my native land, the vegetation of the Caribbean. We also know Guernica had happened by this point, so we see stylistically Guernica. We also know that, I think I mentioned this in this class, that Les Demoiselles d'Avignon is, if you translate the title, it's the prostitutes of the street d'Avignon in Paris, that it was a painting about Parisian prostitutes. Did we do that in this class?
Uh-huh.
Okay, great. So, Wilfredo Lam comes back to Havana and is immediately thrown into this environment where all these Hispanic Cubans are studying Afro-Cubans. He meets Afro-Martiniquians, the Césars. He meets Breton, right? All of these influences flood into his being. He's back to his native land, which he left at the age of 23, and it's a very different country in the 1940s. In the 1940s, Havana is famous for two things, gambling and prostitution. It's a major, major urban center, and the nightlife is fabulous, etc. Let's look at this painting. First of all, you see the vegetation. You see bamboo. You see coffee leaves, right? And you see it all coming in. Do you see it? So there's the vegetation, the bush, surrounding in back of these creatures. So he's placing his creatures in a Caribbean environment. That's why I showed you the picture of him standing in his backyard. Okay? The vegetation is Caribbean. It is Cuban, and it is quintessentially sugar cane and coffee leaves, the two things that slaves worked in Cuba, the two things that the slave economy made Cuba rich for, right? So you see that represented here. Then you see these creatures coming out of coffee and sugar cane, entering out. And these creatures are very surrealist in the sense that you can't quite figure out what kind of creature this is. You can't quite figure out what kind of creature this is or this is. You certainly begin to see gourds that can pass for breasts. You see that? Look around in it. You certainly can see rumps, derrières, whatever you want to call them, right? And here, here, and here. You certainly can see feet. So we know we're dealing with a, you know, something transformational. its core, but it's not quite human, it's transformational. It's in the process of transforming. And then you see areas where you think you're looking at probably male genitalia, like this area right here. In addition, you see very, very large iron scissors. Can't miss them. And then you see a hand holding up a specific leaf here. A hand holding up a specific leaf here. Okay? Here you see a head with horns. And then you look back up and say, oh, it's a head with horns. Here's that sort of male genitalia coming from the chin area. So we're dealing with a painting that really has profited from surrealism, automatic thinking, automatic writing, has really profited from a man coming home again and living in a natural environment he hasn't been in since the age of 23. Most people look at this painting and say, this is Wilfredo Lam's answer to Pablo Picasso. Picasso might have been his mentor, his best friend, the famous one, but this painting, Wilfredo Lam is saying, I've done it. I've created something that is equal to what my mentor did for Europe. I'm doing it for the Caribbean. And I'm doing it in a black way. So all of this commentary is embedded in the painting. So I had mentioned Lydia Cabrera before. And he begins a professional friendship with her. Lydia Cabrera came back from Paris. This is Lydia Cabrera right here. She has a tape recorder on her desk, and she's interviewing an Afro-Cuban who is a member of probably the most radical, most militant of the male societies in Havana during this period. The all-male black societies that fight everybody that they don't agree with, right? She's interviewing him. She goes out and she interviews santeras of the religion Santeria. So she's involved in this kind of research, and Wilfredo Lam asks permission and says, can I go along with you when you meet all these people? She says yes. They become very, very good friends. She is his new mentor. Sort of ironic, isn't it, that a Hispanic Cuban becomes the mentor of this mixed race Afro-Cuban to learn about Afro-religion. Intercultural dialogue. So here's Lydia Cabrera interviewing Santeras. I want you to look at photographs from her book that she first published in 1955. These little heads, now this is not a course in Caribbean, so you don't have to go crazy memorize. These are heads that you make if you are a practitioner of the religion, Santeria. They are called eleguas. I'll spell it the Cuban way, E-L-E-G-G-U-A-S. They're little heads that are used in the religion, and they're placed either on altars or at a doorway. He's a guardian of the crossroads. He's a guardian of transformations. And she publishes these in her book after Wilfredo Lam does his painting. But what I'm trying to say is that, look at these. He's aware of this form of the alegua because he was doing field work with Cabrera. And let's go back. This is where I don't like the fact that it doesn't do well for. I want to go back quickly to the jungle because I want you to look at some of these heads, where am I, that are probably inspirationally based on elegua heads. Elegua is the trickster, the guardian of the crossroads, the guardian of transformation. So, at this moment, we are now in Havana, and I'm going to show you a quick series of paintings And this is going to be really, really condensed. I think every painting I'm going to show you is between, I hope I did it right, between the year 1941 and 1944. So this is all Wilfredo Lam, and it's in this very, very condensed time period of him working, like this burst, this absolute burst of aesthetic energy in his first years in Havana. Here is a drawing of 1943. It is not titled, but it doesn't have to be. Look at the Alegua heads over here that we've been talking about. Look at sort of the Picasso-esque kind of figure here. But why is this woman wearing a chicken in her headdress? Right? Okay, and you'll see a little sort of Alegua head here. What Lam is doing here is illustrating something that happens in Afro-Cuban religious rituals, which is possession and transformation. So what happens, and to understand this very quickly, if you become possessed by a spirit, it always enters through your head. And then you go through a dance sequence or some kind of religious sequence where you are that spirit. You are no longer yourself. So Lam sees this happening because he's doing field work with Carpentier and Cabrera, who are actually writing about it. So this is his inspiration when he's sort of creating his art out of this. Here is a piece called, a painting called Malembo at the Crossroads. I think this is all in the study guide, by the way. And I want you to look at it carefully, because 1943, okay, here are these Alegua heads we've been talking about. Here are your transformed entities. And I want to point out also the vegetation, coming out of the vegetation. But let's look for a moment right here. Do you see that these are horses' legs? Okay. The expression in French and the expression in Spanish when you get possessed is that you are mounted. You are ridden. You are mounted. So what happens is horse motifs enter the visual realm because of the expression of possession is you don't say that you're possessed. You say, I have been mounted, or you have been mounted, right? You have been ridden by a spirit. So here you have the horse, the horse's legs coming into it. If you look at this, you can see, here's an Alegua head, but you can see they're all beings that are transforming one into another, and they're surrounded by this Caribbean vegetation, the sugar cane, and the coffee leaves. Still with me? 1943 again. Green Morning. This, I think, is just such a fabulous painting. Here you have the horse's hooves with iron. There's a deity of iron in the religion. Here are your horse's hooves. Transformed into the rumps, into the derrières that you saw in the jungle, transformed into a female type being with an Alegua head, but this female type being has wings because she's possessed. She's flying away. She's transformed momentarily, maybe for 2 hours or what, into something else. Okay? This is also very important. When you look at the E reserves, look, I don't want to go back. I'm bored with going back. But look again at Demoiselle d'Avignon, and you'll notice that they're offering the clients fruit on a little table in the bottom part of the painting. In Afro-Cuban religion, you offer the gods specific fruits and vegetables. So here we are in somebody's backyard. And you see the sugar cane, and you know, and these beings are coming out in a transformational state. So this is what Lam, think of this. All these paintings, there's more than the ones I've chosen, are happening within this very, very condensed time period. Can you understand the impact about the return to my native country, to use Cesar's words, had on this painter at this point? This is just a huge aesthetic, you know, explosion that happens to him in the first couple years in Havana. This one is called The Murmur. I want to tell you one thing about these titles. It's driving a lot of people crazy. We really, for a lot of these, don't even know what the original titles were. The original titles most probably were in Spanish, because Lydia Cabrera put most of the titles on his paintings. He was a painter, he was not an ethnographer. She was the intellectual who was doing the ethnography. But each of museums that have owned this, or each book that reproduces this, titles them in a different language. So it's really hard. I mean, this one is owned by a museum in Paris, and yet the slide has an English title. So just take a little pause when you see these titles. That, you know, I think there's still research to be done here. But anyway, this is 1943, The Murmur. I think it's blatantly, obvious what we're looking at. We're looking at the sugar cane. We're looking at the transformed individual. We're looking at the gourds hanging from a tree that are becoming breasts. We're looking at a head with little horns that might be an Alegua head, but it's got sort of genitalia hanging from the chin. You're looking at complete transformation happening on a canvas. Yes?
Could it be even close to his transformation to being rediscovering his roots?
You know, I think you could say that. One thing I will tell you, Wilfredo Lam was never initiated in any of these religions, which is the way people write about him sometimes. You wonder if they realize this. He stays as an artist. But he understands what the religion does because he goes to ceremonies. So you might say that, but it might be pushing it a little bit. He certainly has long talks with Cabrera about the religion and what's happening. Here's another one, 1942. Head/woman/horse. What could be more obvious, right? Head/woman/horse. And to me, Guernica comes alive, in a sense, in these paintings also, stylistically. In Guernica, the scream of agony of the bombs caused the transformations. Here, there's that vocabulary put into paintings where the sort of the ecstasy of the religion is causing the style. Mofumba, what does it mean, 1943? I mean, if you saw this on an exam, you could pick out four elements to discuss, could you not? Let's try, you know, just do it right now.
Vegetation.
Vegetation. Feet. Heads. Gourds. Faces transformed. Leaves. Right? Heads, just recombining the elements time and time again. Now I want to show you one painting and sort of express my distaste about art history and books sometimes. Isn't this really different than the ones I've been showing you? I mean, if you had this on a test, you would never know it was a Wilfredo Lam. It really is an anachronism. And yet, Verly Poupée in the book Caribbean Art illustrates his whole career with this painting. I would rather, she said, I could not afford to reproduce any of Lam's famous paintings. Please look them up someplace else. Instead of completely, I mean, yeah, it is a little altar in the middle of the, you know, the backyard and everything, but it is just, he obviously did this on commission for somebody. It's called The Chair. And it's just so different stylistically. I really get angry when art historians sort of fudge things. So that's my little beef. And here's another one, Table in the Garden. the altar, the table in the garden with the offerings of food, with the offerings. That's probably an allegro head in a bowl, in fact, right here on this stool. Okay? But the themes repeat because I'm sticking to this very condensed time period. Now, something else that's left out of all the biographies of André Breton. He had an enormous influence in Haiti, just gigantic. He almost changed the direction of painting in Haiti. Here you have André Breton, his same white suit, right? André Breton, Wilfred Alam, and the French cultural minister at an exhibition, the French cultural minister to Haiti, at an exhibition in Port-au-Prince in 1945. So Wilfred Alam has a one-person exhibition in the capital city of Haiti in 1945. Here they are, you know, standing, being photographed underneath this painting. Totally. And André Breton stays in Haiti and becomes the number one patron of certain Haitian artists, which if you come to my lecture tomorrow, my Caribbean class, I'll be talking about. But it's just left out of the biographies, totally. And here we have 1947 Havana with Fred Alam in his studio in Havana. So it's just showing you. He leaves Havana and 1945-46, Alam returned to Haiti for 6 months. And he had an exhibition there. And then he, in 1945, he had an exhibition in New York City. He did not go, but he and Pablo Picasso were shown together in New York City. He still could not get permission to get to New York. And in 1947, André Breton puts Lam in the International Surrealist Exhibition in Paris. In 1947, Aimé César wrote about Lam in the Paris magazine Cahiers d'Art, the famous Paris magazine.
Isn't there several pieces of his at SF MoMA? Because if that's his painting right there, I feel like I've seen something really close to that at MoMA.
Looks like
Lata. I do not know of a Lam at MoMA.
No, I
really don't. Yeah, I agree. It's probably looks like a Mata, but. They don't know about Mata, but that's okay. But good eyes. I mean, I'm glad that you see the similarities because Mata worked in the same style of surrealism that I've been teaching about. And Mata was South American, so good eyes on that one. I wish that there was a Lam here we could see. And in 1952, Lam was allowed to return to Paris to live. 52. So what I've done, I hope, is, you know, a really condensed, there's a condensed time period here. And what is, you're dying to leave, aren't you? He's already picking up his backpack. but what I want you to think about this lecture in terms of this intercultural dialogue. Because if you start out in Spain, then move to Paris, then move to Marseille, then move to Martinique, then move to Havana, and then back to Paris, and you put all of these elements together, I think you can see, I hope you agree with me, this is cultures in fusion. There was no cultures in collision here. These were eyes open, eyes accepting all these different cultural things that are happening at once. It wasn't putting people on display at a midway, for example. So that I need you to understand this lecture in those broader terms because I'm setting you up for the second half of the course also. So please, I know there was a lot of names some of you never heard of. They repeat, Breton repeats. Right, César, M.A. César, you can actually Google most these names and just realize that we are talking about Paris to the Caribbean, right, and Paris connection here. So don't leave out, like I found out, they leave out the Caribbean in a lot of the information on Breton. So I do need you to understand this lecture, understand why I think this lecture is so important for this class in what it represents in the bigger sense of the word. And now you can leave. There's two tape recorders left here.
I'm coming.
Okay, good. Because I talk about Pollock with Native American art and stuff, but that is absolutely, you could write a short article. It's never, to the best of my knowledge, nobody, and Lom was in New York being shown. I mean, he wasn't there. His stuff was being shown. That's great. Yes, no, I know. That's great. That is really good. Thank you. Bring it up when we do Jackson Pollock in a couple weeks. Really, no, I'm excited by that. No, no, you're right, you're right, you're absolutely right. I'm so excited by that comment. Don't forget to remind me, and then I'll write it in the book. Okay, great.
Oh, I don't know, I just want to push it. Is this way differently? Does it need to be like one a day?
I curve all my
Okay, sweet.